Welcome to The Spot, KALW's showcase for the best in public radio podcasts.
Welcome to the Youth Radio Podcast. My name is Cyrus Abusaba, and today we're going to discuss prescription pill abuse. In 2008, I lost my mother to an accidental overdose of the anti-anxiety medication Xanax. As the coroner pronounced her death, he turned to my stepfather and said, "We're seeing this happen all the time." 6 years later, I was in my apartment cooking dinner while two classmates from San Diego State University crushed up Xanax on the kitchen table behind me. Over the crunching sounds, I heard one of them say, "It's impossible to overdose on this, and if you do, you're an idiot." I was mad, but I just ignored them until they went off in search of a party. Xanax is prescribed to treat anxiety, but I often see it used recreationally on my campus. In an effort to find out why people use prescription pills, I turned to my classmate Omar Ordiano, who's 20 years old and had never seen this type of drug used before college.
It was my freshman year of college, so when I tried a prescription drug. I think it was a Xanax. Well, it was kind of like smoking weed, but I don't think it's as good because, I don't know, I didn't like how you felt after, and it just didn't feel as natural. It felt like a fake kind of high, but at the same time, like, I could see why people would like it, because it's to some people, it's more appealing to them.
Omar was able to understand the appeal of Xanax, but he also caught a glimpse of its dark side.
One of my buddies, he went on like a week-long Xanny binger. Didn't notice the subtle changes until later on, and then like by then he was like knocked out for like a good week, and I was just like, damn, like, this does that to you.
Last semester, a fellow student at San Diego State University overdosed on prescription painkillers and died. I began to wonder how widespread this problem really was. As it turns out, people are seeing this at college campuses around the country. Dr. Niloufar Bavarian, who works at the Prevention Research Center at UC Berkeley, conducted a survey last year to determine the prevalence of prescription drug misuse on Berkeley's campus. She asked students if they had ever used a prescription stimulant without a prescription, if they had ever taken a higher dosage than prescribed, and if they had ever used a prescription drug for non-medical purposes.
What we found was that 92 students self-reported engaging in that behavior, which comes out to approximately 1 in 6 students.
According to the Clinton Foundation, the presence of prescription drugs on college campuses increased substantially between 1993 and 2005. Use of opioids like Vicodin increased by 343%, and stimulants like Adderall by 93%. Dr. Bavarian explained some of the reasons why this might be a problem among college students.
The primary motives are academic in nature. So these are things like to improve focus, to make studying more enjoyable, to stay awake for a long time, and to improve concentration. Students who reported greater levels of inattention and hyperactivity were more likely to report academic concern. And then what we next found was that academic concern was in turn associated with holding attitudes that prescription stimulant misuse was okay. But that's not to say that everyone's intentions are purely academic in nature, because what we did find was we had about 27% of students who misused said that they engaged in this behavior to party longer. And so what that suggests is that they may be co-ingesting with alcohol.
This was something I saw regularly on my campus. At least once a week, I would encounter someone walking to class who was doped out on Xanax. And some nights would see the same students mix the drug with alcohol.
You have prescription stimulants, which are, central nervous system stimulants, and you have alcohol, which is a depressant. Instead of canceling each other out, they actually have a synergistic effect whereby the use of the stimulant while using alcohol masks the depressant effects of alcohol. So a student can be drinking but not realize that they're intoxicated.
What does that mean? It means that students get in their cars and drive, or continue to drink and end up in the emergency room. According to the Centers for Disease Control, unintentional poisoning is the leading cause of accidental death in the United States. Most of this is due to drug overdoses. The CDC has labeled prescription drug abuse an epidemic. I blame this burgeoning death toll on gifting, a practice in which pharmaceutical companies give doctors incentives to prescribe their products. According to a study from the Pew Trust, the pharmaceutical industry spent $24 billion marketing directly to physicians in 2012, and only $3 billion marketing to consumers. Recently passed sunshine laws require public disclosure of these gifts. This is a step in the right direction, but isn't a solution. We need stricter regulation of the medical and pharmaceutical industries that make a living off an epidemic they should be curing. My mom, Suki Palermo, was 47 when she died. I wish I could talk to her, hear her words of wisdom, and show off to her how much her son has grown. I still struggle with her loss, but it hurts worse to see my friends making the same mistakes. For Youth Radio, I'm Cyrus Abusala.
What's that you playing?
You're listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts.
Radiotopia.
Welcome to Fugitive Waves. Lost recordings and shards of sound, along with new tales of remarkable people from around the world. We're the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva.
Walk out the door of the Kitchen Sisters studio in San Francisco, hang a right, go up the block, and you'll be at City Lights Bookstore in the heart of North Beach. City Lights, one of the most legendary bookstores in the country, founded by Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Peter Martin in 1953. Ferlinghetti, a poet, a painter, a social activist, is as fiery and provocative at 94 as he was in 1956 when he published Allen Ginsberg's Howl and other poems, which led to his arrest on obscenity charges. Ferlinghetti was ultimately acquitted, but this landmark First Amendment case established a legal precedent for the publication of controversial work with redeeming social importance. Along with fighting for freedom of speech and working for peace, Lawrence has been observing his neighborhood for over 50 years. Here's a poem we recorded him reading in 2001 about the Green Street Mortuary Band, a Chinese-Italian funeral marching band that regularly goes by his bookstore.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti at City Lights Bookstore. Green Street Mortuary Marching Band just passed by. The back door of City Lights is in Chinatown. The front door is in the Western world. Green Street Mortuary Marching Band marches right down Green Street and turns into Columbus Avenue, where all the cafe sitters at the sidewalk cafe tables sit talking and laughing and looking right through it as if it happened every day in little old wooden North Beach, San Francisco, but at the same time feeling thrilled by the stirring sound of the gallant marching band as if it were celebrating life and never heard of death.
Just about any time we walk out of the office and take that path, we stop and stare in the window of City Lights Bookstore, soaking in the covers of the new arrivals. A while back, we were stopped in our tracks by a photograph of Patti Smith staring down the camera, holding a movie camera herself. It turns out Patti wasn't just the muse for photographer Robert Mapplethorpe. She was also the muse and model for Judy Lynn, an art student and budding photographer in New York. The book was titled Patti Smith, 1969 to 1976. Paging through it, we discovered that Judy had not only photographed Patti, she'd also made little Super 8 movies as the two young women created a world together. The movies were missing, but the soundtracks remained. Lost and found sound, we thought. Gotta get those recordings. Gotta meet that photographer. And we did. Fugitive Waves, episode number 7, Just Girls, The Hidden World of Patti Smith and Judy Lynn.
Is it on? What do I do now? Patti Smith and Judy Lynn.
Well, I'm Judy Lynn. I'm a photographer. I've just published this book, Photographs of Patti Smith, 1969 to 1976.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine.
Patti and I met because we were both in Brooklyn. We met through our boyfriends, Peter Barnowski and Robert Mapplethorpe. We went to Patti and Robert's apartment. Patti was in the kitchen cooking spaghetti sauce, and she didn't really talk to us. And Robert showed us drawings he had done. He'd been at Coney Island that day, and he'd taken off this kind of huge piece of skin from his sunburn. He was going to use it in a drawing. We were all admiring this huge piece of skin that he'd peeled off.
Is it okay if I take my shoes and socks off? It'll be real neat. Then I can show you the ankle bracelet I got on that says Brian Jones, and I always wear it.
I found a cassette Patti and I made in 1969. We were making an 8mm movie in my tenement apartment in Brooklyn. And unfortunately, I lost the movie, but I did somehow save this tape she made.
All right, what do you want me to do?
Look at me. Turn around and go back and look at the wall again.
Oh, okay. Are these clothes okay? Well, I mean, do you want me to put anything special on or ugly on?
I graduated from art school in 1969, and the idea of getting out of school had never dawned on me, so I was completely lost.
Yeah, you really steady with it.
I began photographing Patti Smith because I was taking photographs of everything. And when Patti and I would get together, we would take photographs.
Lay, lady, lay. Lay across my big breast, bed.
I remember the first time we heard Bob Dylan sing Lay, Lady, Lay on the radio. We held hands and screamed.
Lay, lady, lay.
And I had never done that before with anybody. Somehow with Patti, you could be that enthusiastic and silly about something.
Okay, like the reason like my foot's moving like that is because Mick Jagger's on. My name is Patti Smith, and I was born December 30th in Chicago, Illinois. And I was born 6:04 in the morning. People like I hold tribute to, I was like Sonia Henie. I used to like de Kooning. I still like Sag Harbor Woman. Most of all, I like the Rolling Stones. I'm sorry Brian Jones died. Is it okay to come down?
These were photographs in my apartment on Myrtle Avenue. Patti kind of did the set decoration. On the wall are Patti's shoe and sock, a saw, her scarf.
Doesn't my shoe and sock look neat hanging up there?
She's wearing black underpants, a flesh-colored brassiere, some string wrapped around her ankle and string wrapped around her wrist. I really felt like I was shooting for fashion magazines, but I never would have had the guts to show them to anyone.
Put the radio on again.
One of the first times I went to Patti's apartment, she had these little kind of pink acrobat pants, and she put on the pants, and we were taking pictures, and she took her shirt off. It wasn't a big deal. I really think she kind of knew what a more interesting photograph was than I did. The picture on page 7 is of Patti's knees in black tights. Just thought she had such great-looking knees. The photographs with Sam Shepard came about because Patti called me up and she said, I want you to come take pictures of Sam and me. I think it was a really important relationship, and I think she knew it wasn't going to last. It was really a kind of a fleeting moment. He was barefoot. We walked from 23rd Street down to Greenwich Village. She would lie down on the street. He would pick her up. I mean, they were so enraptured with each other.
I just don't know what to do tonight. My head is aching.
like this because, like, we both, like, appreciate minimal movement. I'm gonna step on this because my feet are getting cold. Feet are getting cold.
I like the picture of Patty putting the eyeliner on. It's like she's sticking a pencil in her eye. And I like the idea of, like, drawing with your eye. It's kind of being looked at and seeing at the same time. These were photographs for the Radio Ethiopia album cover. She had convinced the young Getty heir to buy her this walkie-talkie, and she said she needed it to be on the record cover. I think we were trying to do kind of a film noir, you know, like the police are outside, the guy in the raincoat in the rain is out there watching you, hanging out under the streetlight. We both really enjoyed movies. One time we went to see Jacques Rivette's La Religieuse with Anna Karenina as a nun. And we acted out the movie in the bathroom in the movie theater. I mean, we didn't even get home to do it.
Yeah, you know what, like, I don't like about the new filmmakers? It's like they love, like, total chaos. Like, the neatest section of the whole film is when, like, this guy, Jean-Paul Leluc or something like that, Jean-Claude, had to look real bored while I was, like, taking off my blouse. I did it really angular, you know. It was, like, so beautiful. And the guy forgot to put the film in the camera. You know, it was just lost.
I think that we could do this was really about being kids and playing dress-up and playing, oh, look, I can be a princess. Oh, look, I can be a Godard heroine. And by taking a photograph and isolating things, it could look like it was more than it actually was. We weren't really dreaming a future, we were dreaming a present.
Want to try one
in
color?
Yeah.
All these films will be like a story.
I'd love to be a rock and roll star.
Huh?
Be genius to be a rock and roll star. I wonder what's happening with the tape recorder.
Are you recording stuff?
Yeah, I'm recording everything.
Listening to a river, watching it rise, tattoo fingers shy away from me. Voice
Just Girls was produced by the Kitchen Sisters with Thalia Gigerenzer and Nathan Dalton, mixed by Jim McKee, production help from Brandy Howell. You can see some of Judy Lynn's photographs of Patti Smith at kitchensisters.org. You've been listening to Fugitive Waves from the Kitchen Sisters, stories from the flip side of history. Fugitive Waves is part of Radiotopia, a network of some of the best story-driven, creative, cutting-edge radio shows on Earth. Shows like 99%
Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. The Truth.
Benjamin Walker, Theory of Everything.
The Strangers.
Radio Diaries.
Love and Radio.
And us, the Kitchen Sisters. If you are interested in supporting this and other podcasts like it, email sponsor@prx.org.
Our friends at Radio Diaries have a powerful new episode out this week, Strange Fruit, Voices of a Lynching. Here's a preview.
I was pleading for some kind of mercy, looking for a kind face, but I could find none. They got me up to the tree, and they got a rope, and they put it around my neck, and they began to push me under the tree. And that's when I prayed to God. I said, Lord, have mercy and forgive me my sins. I was ready to die.
Radiotopia from PRX is made possible with support from the Knight Foundation, and our launch sponsor, MailChimp, who celebrate creativity, chaos, and teamwork.
If you are interested in supporting this and other podcasts like it, email sponsor@prx.org. You can hear more Kitchen Sisters stories at kitchensisters.org. And don't forget to subscribe to Fugitive Waves, stories from the flip side of history. Radiotopia from PRX.
This- This is The Spot, the best from independent and non-commercial podcasters here on KALW. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Marlo Mack.
How many years I've been.
That's my daughter.
Making the show, doing shows, and how fun.
She's 6 years old.
Like that. Like I'm an actual rock star.
She's transgender.
Okay, I'm ready for the show.
If you heard the first episode of this podcast, you know that my kid was only 3 years old when she told me she wasn't the boy we all thought she was.
I've been working for 20 years now.
And that I spent a year trying to convince her that she was probably just a boy who liked girl stuff.
I've been working for 20 years here and I've noticed that it's kind of hard to act sometimes.
But she wasn't having it. She was a girl.
Being a girl, so much.
My child loves being a girl, probably more than any girl you've ever met.
See a girl down the street, it is usually me.
Like with a lot of things, I think when you've had to fight for something, it means more to you.
Oh, it's fun to be a girl.
If you met us on the street or saw us in the grocery store, you would not guess that my child is transgender. You'd just see a tired-looking mom accompanied by a skinny little girl in a dress. She would definitely be wearing a dress. I don't think she's worn pants even once in the 3 years since she first told me she was a girl. You might also notice that we have the same long, thin blonde hair. Hair is really important to her. She wants really long hair, Rapunzel long. Along with the dresses, the long hair ensures that she'll never again be mistaken for that horrible thing we used to call her. A boy.
Really long.
My daughter just started kindergarten. I told the staff at her school that she was transgender. But we didn't tell the other parents. This strategy really ticked off some of the moms in preschool last year. When they found out that one of the girls at school had a penis, they kind of freaked out.
Penis.
They said they had a right
penis,
to know.
Penis, penis, penis.
At first, I thought this was reasonable of them, to insist on knowing what's in my kid's pants or skirts, but not anymore.
Okay. Please unrecord the penis, penis, penis.
I've thought about this a lot. I don't ask about their kids' body parts or private medical issues. So my kid has a penis under her dress. What's it to you? By the way, none of the kids at preschool had a problem with it when they found out.
I'm always late. Just kind of late sometimes.
But this year, we're in a new school for kindergarten. And no one knows. Yet. I keep wondering what will happen when the other kids and their parents figure it out. We live in a very liberal area. The other parents at school seem cool. I bet most of them are telling their children that some kids have two mommies or two daddies. But I doubt many of them are teaching their children that some girls have penises and some boys have vaginas. I know I probably wouldn't have thought to teach my child about this stuff until my 3-year-old began schooling me on all this. Most people are really wonderful about it, actually. Our neighbors and friends welcomed my child as a girl without hesitation. So did my family, once it became clear that this really wasn't a phase.
Hello, sweetie. Oh, honey.
That's my grandmother.
Aren't you sweet?
She's 100 years old. And she was cool with my boy becoming a girl sooner than just about anyone else in the family.
Red skirt and everything.
Maybe when you're that old, you understand that a lot of the things we get so hung up on, like gender, are just bullshit anyway. I asked her what she thought the difference was between boys and girls.
Well, the older I get, the more I think we're alike.
A few of my friends didn't get on board.
Bad princess.
I'm not friends with them anymore.
Floated away in the muddy river.
Great job. Repeat the tone.
Daily life isn't much different than it is for anyone else with a kid who isn't transgender.
You've got it. Repeat the tone.
I go to work. She goes to school. We do battle over eating her vegetables and bedtime and how many games she can play on my iPhone. And then there are things that are nothing like your life if you don't have a transgender kid. Like my cognitive dissonance when she had a big erection in the bathtub the other night. Or when I talk with friends who have transgender daughters who are a few years older and are starting their hormone treatments to stave off the dreaded male puberty. Like mine, their daughters would rather die than turn into men. Or when my child staged a play for the family at her birthday party, in which she was a woman giving birth to her baby doll.
She asked me if the baby could wait any longer, and I said, no, I don't think so.
And I sat there watching.
I put it inside my shirt.
With my heart kind of cracking.
And I would jump and push it out. And then she would come running and try to catch it.
Thinking about how little she understands.
So I stick it in her shirt, and then what I do.
And about the things I'm going to have to explain to her. Like the fact that if she really does want to be a woman, she will never have babies of her own. She hasn't got a womb, and the hormones she will take will render her sterile as a male.
And then she said, and then I say, here she comes, and basically I push the baby out, and then,
I just don't want to tell my kindergartner that. I'll have to tell her eventually, but not yet. For now, life is good.
Dog poop flavored ice cream.
I try to keep it silly.
You big old.
After all, tough times are ahead for all of us. I just happen to know a little more, a little sooner than most parents do.
This song is called
about the kind of hard stuff that's probably in store for me and my kid.
Nobody knows this as far as it goes. Nobody knows this as far as it goes.
I'm Marlo Mack. This is How to Be a Girl. Thanks for listening.
I've been working for 20 years here and I've noticed that it's kind of hard to act sometimes, but sometimes it gets easier. Yeah.
You've been listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts. Learn more about these and other great radio podcasts at KALW.org.